No, I am not asking Scotty to beam me up. This is my, it's a Creative Zen Micro, and I'm sincerely hoping that it's recording right now. It appears to be. And what I'm actually doing in this presentation is, in the process of delivering the talk, creating a resource. And so if you speak during my talk and possibly some of the discussion after, there will be evidence. I'm going to start the slides in just a second, because my presentation is almost the opposite of the one that just preceded. And sitting there, I was thinking cynically, because I'm cynical, well, we got free as in beer, and now we're going to get free as in freedom. I think we have two different concepts going on here. And I'm not going to respond directly, but I will respond implicitly as I go through what I have to say. And again, I too am limited by time, and I realized as I was writing this morning that I could add another 15 pages on a separate topic, but I won't, because, well, I ran out of time. And sorry about the display like this, but again, my windows are messed up, so you'll have to live with that. And I have to look at it there because I can't see it here. The concept of open educational resources and OERs was a bit of a move for me, but that's okay. Comes with it implicit the idea that these are resources that will be shared. And through the sharing, we see the value of these resources. And there's been a lot of talk about how the value of resources is developed through the leveraging of the value of work. In a traditional publishing model, for example, much work is produced, but a much smaller percentage of that work actually makes it out into the community. Leveraging the value of the work, just in the sense that it's shareable, it becomes more accessible for the author. It means a wider readership. There was discussion yesterday, and there is evidence in surveys, and I believe I cite one, showing that work that is published openly is more frequently cited, more frequently referenced. And it maximizes the value of the investment for funders, because when resources are distributed openly, they reach the widest range of users, which means the per reader or per user cost of an investment in a resource becomes lower. And I think we all agree, I was pleased yesterday to discover that, as someone said, I am indeed among friends here, which as an aside, most surprised me, but it made me very happy. I think we all agree about the value of educational resources. We may agree a bit less on what we mean by resources, and there was some discussion of that yesterday. And of course it includes things like courseware, of course it includes things like content and even academic papers and things like that, and the famous or the infamous learning objects, and we can talk about those if we want. I view this as wider, and I view it as wider for a very specific reason. Not just learning materials, but also aids and supports, things like class outlines, curriculum, programs. We see an awful lot of that are produced out there. So we're thinking beyond just courseware, and therefore, the model that was given yesterday, and everybody was nodding, and I was nodding, you know, about the content and so on, is a little bit narrow. But it's not just digital resources either. Like, I'm standing here in a room in a very nice hotel in Malmo, Sweden. I'm a resource. I'm even a shareable resource, and here's the proof, but I'm not a digital resource. And I think we see a lot of that too. Learning, as we know, is not just getting a book or a learning object or some content. It involves interaction. It involves that second phase, the tutorial or the support. And a lot of times that happens in real life. It happens with a person. So I'm thinking much wider than just digital resources. And we talked about open yesterday a little bit. And I thought about this because my first instinct was to contrast it with commercial resources. And yet, that doesn't really work, does it? Because you can have resources offered by non-commercial organizations, such as publishing societies, which are nonetheless not open because they charge access fees. And you can have resources offered by commercial companies that are free and open. And the classic example is Google. Google is free and accessible to everybody. And it makes it it becomes an open resource in that way. And open to me, well, it does imply free as in free beer, but it means more than that because, and this is something that comes from the field of open source software, it's not just being able to access the resource, but it's being able to use the resource, often to repurpose the resource, to do something with the resource. Now, it does not mean necessarily without constraints, and we may talk about that, there are the various licensing conditions in that, but it does mean a certain degree of access. Have I missed something? No, I haven't. Okay. So anyhow, I'm writing up my paper, and of course it's OECD, so the first thing I thought about was money. And when I looked at it, because I actually did have to stop and look at it, and what I saw was a proliferation of funding methods. I know you're all familiar with these. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be in this room, but I'm just going to review them briefly. The endowment model, the Stanford Encyclopedia is a good example of that, where they're raising or want to raise $4 million and then they'll support the encyclopedia off the interest from that endowment. The membership model, and Sakai is a good example, I've seen some other examples, where a group or a consortium of institutions, such as universities, gets together and each one of them contributes a certain amount of money in order to sustain the initiative. The donations model, which is the most popular in the communities I run in, where you put up a PayPal thing or something like that and say, please give us money because otherwise we'll die. And members or users or whatever contribute money. A common one is called the conversion model, and that actually sounded kind of like rice. The connection systems where you offer something for free and then eventually you commercialize it and then you use the commercial aspect. Maybe it's not, right? I know, I'm just kidding. You get impressions, right? But we see this in the open source community. MySQL, there's the MySQL that is open source software, and then there's the commercial enterprise that follows from that. And we see that with various Linux initiatives as well. Contributor pay, which is an interesting one because you actually pay for the privilege of producing a resource that will be freely shared by all, and you would think that could not possibly work. But the world of academic publishing is a very interesting and strange world where the authors are already used to paying and not getting anything back. And so it works in something like, for example, the Public Library of Science, where the author or sometimes a foundation who is backing the author will pay PLOS for the expenses involved in publishing and maintaining the resource online. Sponsorship, and this is something that we see from time to time, where a company or an organization will find value, typically brand value, in associating itself with an educational resource. And Microsoft does quite a bit of stuff like that. And the example I've put up there is the Stanford iTunes project. Apple is involved in that. It's providing educational resources, for now free, but it'll probably be a conversion model as well. And what Apple gets out of that is brand recognition and increased demand for its product, and it does that by providing the free resources. And that's a model I think that we'll see much more of. It's the old slogan I used to say, Apple uses music to sell iPods, not iPods to sell music. Institutional, where an organization, a university typically, will see it as part of its mandate to produce resources. This is just what it does. It's, as David Wiley said yesterday, it's the right thing to do. And then as part of its mandate, it contributes part of its operating budget to that. Very related to that, obviously, are governmental initiatives. I'm one of those, actually. I work with the National Research Council in Canada, and our government pays money, pays me even. I don't know how that happened, but it did, in order to produce resources that can be used and shared by the community. And SchoolNet is another project in Canada. It's run by, who is it run by? I think it's Industry Canada or Heritage Canada. Which is a network of resources that are available to teachers. And it's just produced, and teachers across Canada are able to access these resources. And it's because it's thought of as part of the mission of the Government of Canada to produce these resources. And then you might think this is an odd inclusion in this listing, partnerships and exchanges. And I picked up on one between Memorial University of Newfoundland and a Brazilian university where there's an exchange. It's not necessarily an exchange of funds, but basically what happens is through the process of partnership, free resources are produced for learners who are in Brazil. And so the Memorial Brazilian partnership is, in fact, a way of funding, if you will, or sustaining open educational resources. So those are the models. And there's an awful lot of models. Now, when I was looking at sustainability, I looked, because I look everywhere, beyond just the financial support. And it seems to me that there are several other categories of sustainability, which I'm going to go through very briefly. I know, because I'm not going to have a whole lot of time here. And because we know that from our own experiences, both working with our governments and elsewhere, that simply having a lot of money isn't sufficient to sustain a resource. I know that because I've been on a project that had a lot of money and it still wasn't sustainable. One of these things is technical. And on reflection, as I looked at it, I'm seeing that a lot of the technical considerations are in fact driven by funding considerations. Consider the whole concept of learning objects, shareable, reusable, discoverable learning resources. And a large motivation for that is based on the need for funding. And the idea is that if you can produce resources that are shareable in this way, you push down the cost of funding. But that brings us into the whole question of what the technical support is going to be, what technologically these resources are going to look at. And there are two major things which I classified as free use as opposed to adapt and localize. And it's a difference in technical model of content, where on the one model, you just get something and you use it. It's like a textbook, but you wouldn't tear out the pages and paste them up on the wall. It's just not that kind of resource. As opposed to the adapt and localize. Other technical considerations that come in as well are just, and this was mentioned yesterday, the discoverability of resources. It doesn't matter how many resources you have if you can't find them. And indeed, in my own experience, because I do look out there or on the web, my own belief is that there is not now even a shortage of educational resources or even open educational resources. I see site after site with hundreds of resources. I look at Flickr and tens of thousands of Creative Commons licensed pictures. The PodSafe Music Network, again with hundreds and soon to be thousands of reusable resources, all kinds of resources there. It's just we can't find them. And I think that becomes a consideration. And even this mechanism is going to place constraints on what we view as open. People who know me from the learning object community will have heard me rail about content federations and identity federations. And a federated system is a mechanism for providing a search through a distributed network, but the creation of a federated system creates a barrier to access, because access to a federated system only exists for institutions that are members of that federation. And so if you have to be in a university as a university student in order to access this federation, maybe the resource is free, but you have to have paid $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 worth of tuition. And to me, that structure of that network changes the nature of the open resources into some kind of subscriber fee. It's a hidden kind of fee. Well, it's not that hidden to the students. So the technical structure of the network that we set up influences whether or not our resources are open. Come back. Content models as well. And we talked about licensing yesterday, so I'm not going to go into that a lot. But I think that as we push our understanding of concept, and we even saw that a little bit here yesterday, by open we're going to mean not just free as in free beer, not just free as in stuff we can pull off the shelf, but free as in freedom, in the sense that the content that we use, the open educational resources, are things that we can rework, remix, repurpose, redistribute to localize, and that came up a lot. And that in turn means that there is a semantical element to these resources, in the sense that the resources that are brought in need to be semantically relevant to the community in which they're used. The primary example, of course, is language, and it's useful to have a resource in the language that the students speak. But it extends a lot more beyond that. And in Canada, and I'm sure in Europe, we run into issues of cultural sensitivity and things like that. And even like I put in my paper, logical notation, you wouldn't think, but there are different types of notation in formal logic. And if you've taught students using one notation, then to import a resource in another notation creates a dissonance for them. This is going to bring in, and this is the major point that I wanted to stress in what I had to say today, is that it puts into question the whole provider-consumer relationship. And we heard yesterday the discussion, the talk about the potential for cultural imperialism, the exporting of a certain model. And you heard all my cynical remarks about MIT and what they're up to. And I'm kind of glad the recorder was off then. And what we're seeing, and we're seeing this outside the institutional arrangement, we're seeing this in the community at large, a shift from the model where there is a provider and a consumer and forever they shall stay apart, to something like collaborative development. And that came up a lot in the discussions, the UNESCO discussions from a couple of years ago. And we are seeing that. If you look at Wikipedia, for example, and if you look at a lot of the new initiatives, we're seeing a lot more emphasis on collaborative development. So we cannot think of open educational resources, and I mean this quite literally, it's semantically not possible to think of open educational resources without at the same time thinking about the community that uses them. I need to underline that. And that brings us to staffing. And it was interesting, the Connections presentation, and it was the whole idea, oh, we want everyone to come to Connections, everyone come here. That's the whole sustainability model. And it's funny because, you know, it reflects in a way that traditional model where you bring people in, maybe you hire them, maybe you lure them in with nice software or something, and they'll come in and they'll produce things, and then those things will be sent out and consumed. And that is the traditional model, and we see that in many cases with open educational resources. But if you bring people in, if you hire staff, if you have professionals, that has huge implications on the cost. And you guys can all look at the numbers as well as I can, what it costs for the Open University to develop content, for example, as compared to what it costs for Wikipedia to develop content. And it's, you know, they're not even remotely close to orders of magnitude. And so consequently, in the field of open educational resources, we see a great deal of emphasis on volunteers. Now, I've talked before about how sustainability depends on the people who are providing the resources, what counts as sustainable is determined by whoever is funding it. And we saw all the different funding models, which means there are all kinds of different types of sustainability. But now sustainable becomes a question of what sustains the volunteers, what keeps them going. And we know that volunteers work under different motivations, non-financial motivations. And again, as David said, they're motivated by doing the right thing to a large degree. And so our model of sustainability has to reflect that. Two major types of volunteer organization that I could detect in the open educational resources community. One of them is the community model. And you see that a lot in open source software. The Apache Foundation, very explicitly a meritocracy. People play very definite roles and responsibilities. Again, with Apache, you've got like 30 or 40 or whatever vice presidents and all of that. Everybody does a particular thing. As opposed to that is what might be called the emergent model, where the identity of the user, I mean, you still have an identity, but that person's role is less important, and rather it's the way that they interact or work with the system. And these are very different models. On the emergent model, and I've got eBay up there, and that the participation in the community is undertaken through a series of small, autonomous, and usually self-directed actions. For example, DIG is a site that was mentioned yesterday, and participating in DIG means clicking either dig this or don't dig this, where dig this elevates a resource higher on the list, and don't dig this lowers it. And it's a very simple quality measuring system. And there are a lot of things like that, recommender systems and interaction systems where people do small actions in order to create information as a whole. And I think that if you take those two models and if you combine them, and if you combine them with the idea of consumers and producers merging together, you get a lot of the approach that we find in what's being called Web 2.0. There was some discussion of this yesterday and some question of, you know, what is RSS, how does all of that work? And I didn't actually solve my CSS problem, and I don't have internet access, so I can't show you. But the whole idea is that the community becomes the entity that produces the resource. And the idea of Web 2.0 is that the mechanism of production is the same as the mechanism of consumption. That there is no real distinction to be drawn. Think about workflow. Think about how we traditionally develop resources. You know, the design, the content production, we'll run it through some pilot projects, all of that, then we'll do some evaluation and that. And the mechanisms that make this possible. And through every step of that process, and people have written like books, volumes of books on this, you know, oversight, management, quality control. The classic example I bring forward to highlight this is the example of Merlot. And Merlot, as you all know, is an open educational a repository of open educational objects. And Merlot operates on a peer review system such that the resources that come in are reviewed by a panel of peers, if you will. And this creates a bottleneck. I forget what the exact percentage was, but only a very small percentage of the resources that have been submitted to Merlot are reviewed. And so the choice becomes, choose between a completely unreviewed resource or one of very few that are available. The contrast to this mechanism of production with the structures and the controls is to rethink the idea of producing, to decentralize the system, to disaggregate the system. This is what bothers me about connections and other initiatives, and they want everybody to come to them. But as soon as that happens, you hit all kinds of issues of not just control, but scaling, management, resources, bandwidth. And if you look at the way resources are being produced on the web now, it's decentralized, it's uncontrolled. It's, remember when you did the survey to find out what's being done in open educational resources, and it wasn't at the institutional level, it was at the individual level. And that is where a lot of this work is being done, and it's virtually invisible. Almost there. So, sustainable open educational resources. If we focus and fixate on content, I think we're missing actually 90% of the picture. And my own feeling is that content is the least of the issues, particularly in an environment where content is produced on the fly through use. We can produce content like crazy. It's not hard.